You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network. Visit jabberjawmedia.com for more shows like this one.
All right, folks, welcome back to the show. We're keeping it up going with the producer series here. I'm going back and forth. Obviously, I did something different last week with that How to Lose $5,000 episode, which has been quite the hit, let me tell you. That's been going around and everybody I know in the industry. People seem to be really blown away just that we gave the details of that and I thought it was funny. Our manager and people got thrown under the bus. My manager, you know, he said that he really enjoyed the episode, but he was real bummed when he first heard it. But hey, we're just trying to explain what's going on and what it feels like. I'm not trying to make anybody look bad. In fact, I really respect everybody's point of view all the way around and just wanted to show ours. So much so, I've got some really good news. I think you're going to love this too. Next week, and I'm not joking about this, next week we have the promoter of the festival. His name is Czar, and he's going to be on the show. I've got him booked this week coming up. I'm going to talk to him and ask him his point of view, and I'd be glad to hear it. And maybe he's got some great stuff to say, and maybe I'm a big jerk. But I'll give you some more updates on what's going on there, and we'll actually hear from the promoter of the failed festival next week. So stay tuned for that. And like I said, continuing with the producer series this week, I've got Ed Rose. Ed Rose is one of my favorite producers of all time, and he's the person that recorded and produced the first Emery album, The Week's End. We went to Kansas in 2003, saved up our own money, and went to our favorite producer before we were signed, before anybody gave a shit who we were, and we recorded with Ed Rose, who is incredible, very cool, got lots of stories and stuff I'm going to talk to him about today. So that's excellent. Thank you to everybody for the support you've been giving me. You guys kick ass at doing the Amazon banner link thing. So go to my website, go to breakitdownpod.com, click the Amazon link, bookmark it, save that link, and whenever you shop on Amazon, I'm actually getting dollars. And it doesn't cost you anything other than what you normally are spending, and I'm actually getting dollars that's helping me. It's helping me pay for child care for my daughter Georgia and get the show going. Also, of course, if you'd like to actually pay for the show, even better. And a lot of people are starting to do that. And that is same thing. Go to my website, breakitdownpod.com, and click contribute and pay, you know, dollar episode, $10,000 an episode, whatever makes sense to you. But at the very least, if you're going to spend an hour with me a week or at all, then it makes sense for me that you would share the show, that you would tell somebody else. If it's worth it to you to just sit here and listen to me talking to your earphones for an hour, then share the show. I'd appreciate it very much. Okay, let's talk to Ed Rose, talk about Emery, Week's End, recording, drums, production, whatever.
Break it down, Dada.
Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down. Break it down, oh, break it down.
Let's Matt Carter.
Yeah.
What's up, Matt?
Hey, Ed, how's it going?
It's going.
Good. I'm glad to talk to you today.
Yeah, it's been a while.
So you've been doing any podcasts? I've heard you on at least one. I've heard you on Pryor's one time at least.
Yeah, no, I've done a couple. Pryor's and a couple others that are just escaping me at this point.
Mm-hmm. Do you enjoy it? Because I'm wondering because I get this thing like where I get nervous right before I do a podcast, and it's the weirdest thing. I notice it because I'm doing this tech setup or whatever, and I'm on the bus coming down here today, and I find myself already just like, I wish I didn't have to do this today. That's the way I feel about it. And
no.
But it's something based in nervousness, and it's something based, it's like some little, it's the thing that makes me want to do it. I think I equate it to, you like a comic says, going on stage or a performer, you know, it's like, I need that rush of it. So something about that that does this podcast thing, I'm thinking, I've got to talk to Ed. I've got to get the technical stuff right. I hope he enjoys it, all that stuff. And I, you know, do you have that same thing? Is there anything about producing that you have that pull to?
Not really. I mean, with recording, I've just been doing it so long that I don't know if there's anything that you could throw in front of me that would, shock me, surprise me, make me nervous at this
point. Was there ever the thing that makes you want to keep doing it? The love hate thing, or like the on the spot part of it? Is there not that?
I would say, you know, back in the day when I started and it was all tape based. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of that because there was a lot more, pressure on me to get things right the first time.
Yeah.
And as things went, into the computer, then that kind of goes out the window because you don't have to worry about nailing a sound on the way in or screwing up a punch in or any of that stuff. So, I don't know. At this point, no. But, in the beginning, yes.
Yeah, I can see that on the tape stuff, and the more pressure and I guess the bigger budgets and studio time kind of give you that effect. But there's not that immediate thing like performing or broadcasting or, something like that is, I suppose.
Well, exactly. And, with podcasts, for me, I think maybe on the first one I got pretty wound up beforehand because I didn't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. But, after I did it, it's like, there's no way you can look into the crystal ball and know what questions you're going to be asked or anything. Yep. So it's better just to go into it with a, good attitude and just do your best to answer it as things come up.
All right. Well, let's start by talking about, I like to talk to producers and tech people, do tech stuff and get into that. But in this one, we have a particular thing in common that we both worked on our first record, The Week's End. So I want to spend a little bit more time on that than I typically would on a record of somebody I talk to. But let me just start. I have so many thoughts about that, and I'm sure you have many, many less thoughts because it's just but one record you recorded, whereas it's my first experience recording a record. But if your memory fails you, totally fine. But what do you recall about doing that first record with us, the Emory record?
Man, what I recall,
it's fine you say, I barely remembered. It was two weeks or whatever.
I was going to say, I think, the things that stick with me are, a bunch of driven, hardworking kids from South Carolina that, came in well rehearsed and prepared to make a record and worked their butts off during the process. I mean, was that a 10-day record?
Yep, it was 10-day.
I think, because I did do a little cheating last night and listened back to to the record. And for 10 days, I think that's pretty, to this day, is a pretty solid record.
Yeah, I think the 10-day thing was just incredible. I didn't know any better looking back on it, but it was it was such a weird time for us because it was so it was like the most intense thing ever. And this probably contributed to my memory, which I may have a little bit different than the way it really was. But in my memory, it was just the most intense time of my life because we had all the chips down. We saved our own money and we're going there to do this. And it was working with somebody that we thought was just like an idol or somebody we dreamed to work with. And now it's going to happen. And do we really have what it takes? And, it was all our money and a couple years of work and everything to do it for us. And we didn't have any success at all before that. We weren't signed, didn't have a record deal, nothing. We just thought we could do something. And so it was so intense going in there that it's really hard to describe. And then at the same time, coming up against you, it was just so, the only thing I can say is I found you so intimidating at that time. Like, and I thought the way that you acted was so, only way I can describe it now is it was like, it wasn't authoritarian or mean, but it was very, almost like fatherly or something. It's like, well, I want this guy to approve. And you assume that role so much of just, this is what you got to do. I don't know if you could sense that we didn't know what we were doing. Might've been part of it, but it was, this is my quote I always tell people. I say, well, we went to Ed Rose and we did that first record and he was amazing, but he wasn't even nice. That's what I say. You weren't even nice the whole time, the way I remember it.
Well, I apologize for that, but, in a record like that with a band that was that young, that new to the record making process and 10 days, I mean, there's not a lot of time where you can, be buddy buddy
right
and,
on.
Dick around and stuff like that. I mean, it's got to be down to business,
That is right. Well, down to business is the way I just have just always described. And like I said, that probably plays into me a little bit more given the thing. But here's what I remember from it. Is we went in there the first day, we're standing around, we'd probably been up for 3 hours before you came in. I mean, we just were so wired. We had the drums, we were all standing around in a circle. You came in the control room And then we were just standing in there and you did some stuff in there and hadn't said hey yet or anything. We were just dying. Then you finally come in the room after about 5 minutes of us seeing you through the glass and you came in and said, okay, well, you know, you can put the drums here and we'll get started and what something like that. And he goes, oh yeah. And I saw that some, and just all you said, the only thing he said, I saw that some of you have cameras. He said, it's okay if you take pictures, but don't take any pictures of me. And I'm serious about that. And you turned around and walked away. That's the only thing you said to us the first day. It was just like terrifying for us.
Well, no. And, you know, in the picture thing, I mean, I just, that's something that I just, it's a hang up I had.
What was the hang up there? I never asked you about it since.
Well, I just don't like having my picture taken. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's as simple as that. And it wasn't anything to do with anything other than my hang up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found that really, it just added to the intensity kind of thing of it. And we didn't know how to tune the drums, what we were doing at all and stuff like that. And then I remember too, the thing about it that is, it was right sandwiched somewhere in between you working on Motion City's record and Rocket Summer record.
Mm-hmm.
And so when just in making casual conversation, the first few things you were saying was, you were talking about Motion City and, you know, had reasonable things to say about them, but you were trashing Bryce so hard about the Rocket Summer record. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah, no, that was one of those records that, I came home from every day during the recording of that mm-hmm. and was like, and would tell my wife, man, I don't know if I can do another day of it. you know, from the first phone call I had with Bryce, you know, things were weird and, you know, the reason why I think I kept going with it is because it was, you know, one of those records where I knew that I was going to only have to put in 8-hour days and it went on for weeks. So it was mm-hmm. a chance to have somewhat normal hours and make, you know, decent money on it. But I mean, from a compatibility standpoint, you know, that was just not a good fit. Sometimes you get into that in the studio and, sometimes you can figure out ways to make it through it. And sometimes, you know, you just have to bail on it. But that was one of those things where, no, I mean, if you ask Bryce about it, he'd be like, yeah, no, we were like oil and water in the studio. Yeah.
It was so funny because we just, you know, like I said, we're trying to warm up and get comfortable here. And you're like, and all you were doing was talking about how crappy the last person you worked with was. We're like, oh gosh, he's going to say that about us. And it was like, he couldn't play. He wanted to do it. Like, what was the beef? But what was the thing that made that so difficult for you? I can't remember exactly what you were saying about it.
Well,
but
going into it, he made it very clear to me that I was not his first choice, you know. And, you know, when you're working with someone and they're constantly saying, well, you know, you weren't my first choice. You know, I'm only here because, you know, my first choice, you know, was going to be too expensive. And also, I think, you know, from the record he wanted to make and where my head was making records, those two just didn't line up very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of it was getting mired, for me, it was getting mired down in a lot of like the busy work of Pro Tools, a mm-hmm. lot of the editing stuff, which, you know, has honestly, you know, driven me crazy. So yeah, there was a lot of that and a lot of just, you know, us not really even liking each other as people very much. So yeah, from top to bottom, you know, that thing was going to be a struggle from the get go.
I wonder what would make somebody like him doing his first record that have that much, I don't want to use the word arrogance, but confidence or whatever it is, or unawareness to have that much going into a first record. Cause that was really, I guess, first record.
Well, yeah, no, I think, he had had, some manner of success before, mm-hmm. We started in on that. And, I think, you know, he felt pretty good about, not only, I think, kind of where he was musically, but all of the things that he had kind of been setting up, because he didn't have a label at the time we recorded it, but he had been courting a bunch of labels, so mm-hmm. he knew he was going to have a home for it. So I think, you know, given his previous success, he was probably, you know, feeling pretty good.
That's pretty funny. I just remember thinking, well, that's something else. And, but yeah, you were all business, so it was like you were, and even at that time, you were doing really pretty much 9 to 5 hours. You'd come in at work every day. And it was so formative for me looking back on it, seeing it, because you would put your head between the speakers and focus for 8 hours. And then somewhere in the middle of the day, you'd say, okay, you'd turn around and say, I'm going to eat lunch now. and then you would sit back and eat a bowl of noodle soup and an apple and at the console for 15 minutes and then start back working again. And yeah, that was it. You did that, I did that all day for 10 days straight. I guess is what you got to do.
Yeah, no, that's it. You know, that's just kind of the way I work. I like to, when I'm at work, I like to work and not work when I'm at home.
Mm-hmm. And we did pre-pro coming in too, which is cool. So we had sent you all our demos, and you deserve a lot of credit for making those songs turn into, a lot of those songs were 6 and 7 minutes and stuff like that. And so we had all this music and all these parts, and our music's kind of all over the place anyway, as far as not traditional form songs. But we got in there, I was excited to do pre-pro, and you said, okay, well, let me show you what I've done. And I was thinking, I wonder what parts he wrote and what stuff did he do. And then you just played all our songs back with several minutes chopped out of each one. And so that was pre-pro. I was like, well, okay. But it was unbelievably completely the right thing. And when I hear those songs today, I'm like, I am so glad that instrumental part didn't repeat 4 more times. I mean, cool. Everything you did made it. I mean, I hear other bands making the mistake all the time. And every time I'm ever working with somebody, that's that's the way I look at it. That's the way I say, you got to chop this, you got to chop that. And it's like, you don't need to have that thing happen 2 more times before the vocal comes in. It just does not need it. Mm-hmm. And that and whole sections of our song were just gone. And that was stunning to me, because I thought, well, pre-production is all this creative stuff, but it really was getting rid of all the bullshit that we had in our songs that did not need to be there. So that was a big deal, I remember thinking at the time. Did you do that? Is that your typical approach, or just how we struck you?
Well, no, I think, you know, with anything, you know, I try to reduce everything down to the simplest it can be. And especially when it comes to arrangement, I think bands, especially like yours, where you got a bunch of players in the band, can tend to like dwell on a part that is either really fun to play, mm-hmm. That, you know, for the average listener is like, okay, I get the idea, you know, after a couple repetitions, and we don't need 8 of them. So that's basically with arrangement. All I try to do is to, you know, approach it from the casual listener standpoint. And, you know, if this part's awesome and it's really inspiring, yeah, let it go. But if it's just kind of the same thing over and over again, you know, try to pare it down to where it's, you know, just the necessary part of the arrangement, really.
Yeah. And then you were such a hawk on the click. I'd never really paid much attention or thought about clicks or timing. It was weird to be that far along, and I hadn't really thought about timing other than, well, you just try to play together. And I remember listening to the click right there in the speakers and listening to a guitar part or a bass part and saying, well, that's early and that's late and stuff like that. And I didn't, it's so bizarre to look back on now, but I didn't hear that. I was looking at it and just saying, well, what does he hear? How can you tell if it's early or late? Because it was stuff that was, you know, really pretty close. I mean, it wasn't way off, but you could hear this and that. And you kept just making revisions, say, well, try that again, go this way, that's a little behind. And I had done recording and stuff before, just on 8 tracks and 4 tracks and stuff like that. And I never had seen it done professionally or really been around professional musicians at that point in my career. And so I was just like, well, I guess I can't do that. I mean, you know, some people have other skills and I'll never be able to do that kind of thing. And it wasn't even a year or two later. And it's just so bizarre to look back on how much I can hear timing and tuning and things like that I didn't realize at the time. But that was my first exposure to seeing somebody use their ear, you know, in that way. And you were saying you had to get everything right there at the thing. And one thing that I thought was interesting about it was not hardly any overdubs, no doubles, no layering. You're like, we don't want to make guitar soup. You say one guitar on one side, one guitar on the other side, and we're going to get it right. And then we're going to move on. And it was just super disciplined approach. And then the thing from my point of view that's so interesting about that is we did our next record with Aaron Sprinkle. Mm-hmm. And Aaron's very much opposite you in approach. And you both have the same type of abilities and ear and things like that in a lot of ways. It's not like a different type of even product, really, but it's the way you work is completely different, which blew my mind as well. And so we've done a few records with Aaron, and then I worked with Aaron at his studio for several years and engineered his records for a long time. So I've done a ton of stuff with him, but it's so bizarre looking the way he did stuff. He would just go, okay, get a double, get a this, do it 3 or 4 times, and then he would just always keep leaving the room. Almost never in the room, almost never put his head in the speakers. And I remember thinking, after doing a record with you and then doing a record with Sprinkle, like we were 3 weeks into recording our second record, and I was like, is he ever going to work? Is Sprinkle ever going to do anything? That was what I kept thinking the whole time. And it's just so opposite. He just acted like he didn't care and it was all going to be just fine. And I understand his ways a lot better now, but it was really for him, he spent so much more focus on the personal and the artist, and then he would stay up all night and just seriously stay up all night tuning and editing by himself. He just wanted to be alone. He didn't want anybody ever around when he would do that kind of work kind of thing. And you
right.
would make sure that it was already done before you get done with this guitar part on that track. So is that you just – you're not a guy who likes to sit and edit all night, for instance.
No, I hate editing. That's fucking what drove me out of yep. making records. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when I started doing records on Pro Tools, there was maybe a year where I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. I can fix a lot of stuff. This is great. And then when it turned into quantizing everything, tuning mm-hmm. everything, that's when I was like, you know, I don't enjoy this anymore at all. I mean, the thing I loved about recording was, you know, interacting with musicians and, mm-hmm. You know, the creative part of it. Editing is not creative. Editing is drudgery. I mean, it's as awful as running an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And I just never could get past that.
But yeah. you were compelled to do it though. Like you didn't, you know, you would do, yeah. you did what you would, you were big on, I mean, you were very sharp on editing and replacing and getting things right and being able to do that right, you know, and do it amazingly. Within 5-10 minutes of the guitar player walking out of the booth, you would already have it cleaned up. But I remember it was very meticulous and very good editing. You would just do it super fast and get through it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because to me the editing part was just the drudgery that came after takes. You know, it wasn't any, you know, it was one of those things where at the end of the day, when a kid listened to your record, I wanted him to go, man, those guys can play. You know, mm-hmm. that feels awesome. And that just, you know, like in a record like yours, there was some editing, but not like it turned into a couple of years down the road.
Yeah, it did. That was kind of the beginning of the time. What Pro Tools were you on then? 7, 6.3 probably or something like that.
I have no idea.
it was really early still, and it wasn't like everybody was doing all the editing and replacing that came in really the next 3 or 4 years after that. It changed. Mm-hmm. It changed a whole lot and became, I guess, a really expected thing. So was that a continual bum out as the trend moved more and more toward those kind of perfection things?
Absolutely. It got to the point where, you know, with, I would say, a combination of musicianship and then trends in production, where it kind of turned into every session it was, you know, record maybe 5 takes of the drums, chop together the best bits, then quantize those best bits, mm-hmm. then sound replace the kick, snare, toms. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I was spending all of this time doing all this editing, and it would have taken me, you know, if I would have just programmed the drums, which is ultimately how they sound, mm-hmm. I could have had all the drum tracks done by lunch of the first day.
Yeah.
and that's when, you know, I really started just, you know, it's like, oh, great, I got to record this band with a shit drummer, and you know, I can look into the crystal ball and know that, you know, we're going to go through X amount of days of me dragging him through tracks, you know, trying to get stuff that's close enough that I can quantize. And then I'm going to have to replace all these sounds. And it's that's disgusting to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially the worse the music is, the worse the players are, and the worse you like that style of band. That gets to be
absolutely.
Ultimately just, you know, I had a really good momentum and resume going at one point, and I it was a similar thing just for about 3 years ago for me, where I had a whole bunch going, and it was like, okay, well, I can just take new baby bands from labels that sound like this, and I know what to do and I know what they want to do. Or a lot of people would have said, well, that you were so, you had what everybody wants to do for a career, you could go do that. And I felt lucky that I didn't have to record, for instance, local bands or even anything like that. I could actually record real bands with some budget on labels, and it feels like, I mean, babysitting or just process running kind of a thing. And it just didn't seem appealing. So I always said, yeah, I'll do it, but I just never took any gigs. I would say, well, I should be writing music. I should be making podcasts. I should be learning new stuff. And mm-hmm. ultimately didn't find it didn't have... Even something like producing music didn't ultimately have enough creativity when you put it that way. It just wasn't like I thought I'd do creative things, like record music, everybody would say. Right. And it wasn't, at least in 2008, 9, 10. I think it maybe is swinging a little bit of a different direction now, which is kind of refreshing with some, you know, people are doing some things differently. I think they've taken that as far as they can take it, you know, with the machine sound and everything, kind of believe, mm-hmm. I think. So, but yeah, it's just not that appealing to do it that way. But to me, it was real Frankenstein-y to see that you were able to actually make or replace stuff. I wasn't familiar with that at the time. And we did have a kind of a weak link. Our drummer, Seth, wasn't really very good. And like I remember on one song we had, he just, you know, you made it very apparent that he couldn't play it. Mm-hmm. Like we had the song, we wrote it, and the drummer could not play the part. And it's like, what are we going to do? And so you made him sit down and play each hit. You just like kind of rolled your eyes, okay, play the kick drum. Play your kick drum again. You know, we tried it for probably 45 minutes or 15 minutes probably. And then you're like, okay, we'll just hit the kick drum. All right, hit the snare drum a few times. Okay, now play this. And, you know, just you gave him like three or four instructions. And then you just built the drum loop. And we made it into kind of a loop and used it for the whole song. So I'm going to play that one. But this drum part, when we didn't ever play the song live because he couldn't, once we realized he really couldn't actually play it well, we just never even did the song. While he was in the band, we just never played the song. But this part on this record, which is the main drum part, our drummer Seth to this day still never played it. No way. It's just built by you, but here it is. It's that loop there, that, you know, those three kick drums in a row, he wasn't able to hit them with near close enough together with near enough velocity to make it, you know, actually work. So, and so he never played that part before, and it was on our record, which blew my mind that there was a part on our record that nobody played.
Yeah, well, I mean, but, you know, I would say that you know, from the dawn of the Pro Tools era, there were probably plenty of records plenty of songs on records that I made that had similar things. Where, I mean, especially on the, you know, that song there, you know, that da-da-da-da, I mean, getting those three bass drums to feel good, mm-hmm. and not only from a timing standpoint, but from a velocity standpoint. I mean, that's, you know, that takes a pretty good right foot.
And I remember feeling like, well, that does sound a little bit, almost unnatural sound. It sounded a little bit robotic kind of at the time. But then I remember just a year or two later hearing songs and going, oh, now I know what this is. And this doesn't sound anything like real drumming in a way. Mm-hmm. But it became normal. And when the moment that happened for me, I was in Hot Topic, listening to the new record from seriously probably my second favorite band in the world. Reggie is, mm-hmm. is really my second favorite band, I would say, probably. And I heard I've got a clip from that. And this is like taken right there from the week's end from 2003 to maybe 2 years later where you were recording. And it's even more mechanical like that. But let's listen to it for a second.
Oh, yeah, folks.
You know, it's faster. Those kicks are so close together. And it sounds like a normal song to me now. But I was like, oh, that's not playing. It doesn't sound like exactly like a machine. But those kick drums are clearly not play. It's not that there's no drummer's good enough. It's just that's a different thing at that point. And it became acceptable, and the ear goes, oh, you started to learn how to listen to music that way.
Well, and I think on there was a Reggie. I think it was like Lord of the Bling or something. Is that what that was from?
That's something from the Under the Tray album.
Okay. There was a period there where, you know, when James and I were working together, where, you know, we had been recording drum tracks with him, you know, just going in and doing it. And mm-hmm. Then we did one thing where we basically pieced it together, just like we were talking about with your track. And he was like, holy shit, this is so much easier.
Yeah.
And then we can totally change the drum part later, you know, and we can do this and that. And there was a period there where we did that on a number of his tracks. Mm-hmm. And for Reggie and the Full Effect, you know, I thought a lot of that seemed fine. But I think in some of the later stuff, we went back to having Ryan Pope play on it just because mm-hmm. I mean, that dude's a drum machine, but with feel, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm not opposed to it. I'm saying Reggie and that record and the promotional copy are just my favorite. And to me, it's really hard to describe. I try to tell people this, but it's so good, but it's got such a sense of humor to it.
Totally.
It's just funny. I mean, but it sounds like a thing. Like, to me, it's the biggest compliment in the world that music can be good and funny. That's unbelievable to me. I love the B-52s. Mm-hmm. I like Reggie and the Full Effect. And I just think if you can be that fun or even have a sense of humor to it and still be moving, that's incredible because the two don't always go together. And I think that all that stuff that James does in the attitude and stuff, totally, it's not like you can forgive the program he drums around. It's like totally part of it. I wouldn't have it any other way. And it's almost like the tongue in cheek about what music is. I don't even know how to describe it, but it totally connects with me. And even the guitars are super, I imagine they're pretty direct guitars, or how does some of those guitars seem to me to be very...
I think pretty much all of that stuff was probably through my Marshall. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that stuff was at that period, or like on the one record we had Corey White play all the guitars, he may have brought his Mesa in. Mm-hmm. But early on, you know, like the first,
you don't ever do direct or simulated guitars.
No, that's not the era, you know, that I grew up in. I mean, you know, for some reason, you know, sure, we have tons of decent sounding AM simulators in the computer now, but I'm still a hardware guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's some more drums from our record that are, this really sounds like that room to me. Does that sound like that room
completely,
to you?
Completely, especially in the bass drum.
Yeah, it's a pillow, it's got the attack, and then this second, almost separate element of roominess to the kick. And it's very much in that time period, and very much in that room of yours. There's so many records that you've done that have that same sound. I was so happy to hear. To me, those are Ed Rose drums, and it's because I partly the room and just the way you do them. And I just thought that was so cool to have a section on our record that's exactly the sound. So it was, you know, in a lot of ways, it came from, one of the first things you said was, well, it doesn't come from, the drum sound comes from right here. You held up your hand and said, this is where your tone is. You said the same for guitar. I never forget that. That's what it sounds like. But in this particular case, you can actually hear the room and those kind of things. Do you hear, the room like that? You think it would have been different if we did it at a different studio? Think it would have mattered?
Well, from as much as the room mics got used in the final mixes of your record, mm-hmm. Yeah, you probably recorded them about anywhere. Mm-hmm. Just because, you know, that in particular is a good example of them kind of coming through. But I think through the course of most of the record, you don't get a lot of that.
Yeah, in the rest of the tracks, if it's not, the only two places I played on so far, just two isolated almost drum tracks, but you can really hear it. And I thought that was neat to look back on it, to look back on drums from, whatever, 2003 now, because they sound so different now. And it was, special time, really. And then I thought another funny thing you did is, we were doing a song called As Your Voice Fades, and we wanted to do a lo-fi or something thing we told each other at the beginning of it. So we did that, and we said, okay, we're sitting back on the control room couch and said, why don't we make it lo-fi, like it's an old radio or a telephone, and then you could put like maybe a record scratching sound underneath it, and it would sound, you know, like it was coming through an old radio or whatever. And or maybe we described it like, let's do something different here. I don't think we laid it out that way. And then you made something that was a little more outside. Like, I don't remember what you did to process. I really wish I did, but you made some really interestingly outside process thing that I hadn't really heard to be different. And we're like, no, more like a record scratch and an old telephone or radio sound. And you put your head down 2 or 3 seconds. And then you lifted your head up and you clicked on the computer for about 2 minutes. And then you said, is this what you want? Hit space bar and turn around. This is what you were looking for? And it was just the real cheesy kind of lo-fi normal thing. And to us, it was like, well, that's such a cool idea, but obviously ultra cliche to you. And you were super frustrated that we wanted to do the obvious cliche thing for an intro to a song. So you must have gotten that a lot. I wish I could remember what you had done originally that was different than that. But then we went back and we kind of landed up in the middle. But this is the part that you were annoyed that we did such a standard lo-fi. We agreed to ditch the record scratching part.
Good choice.
But people do like it, though. I mean, people love the song and they love that intro. And, you know, I don't know. But you had what are some of the other cliches like that just kill you when bands ask for?
Man, breakdown before the last chorus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. But the whole AM radio record scratching thing was it was one of those things that after it actually became a cliche and I had to spend so much time talking bands out of it, it's like,
mm-hmm.
you know, let's do something new. Let's do something that isn't like, oh, there's the AM radio sound.
And then the rest of that song, as you put it, is all hollering. You just mm-hmm. called her screaming, hollering in a very dismissive way, which we thought was funny, not mean or anything like that. But you've done a bunch of records with screaming and hollering on them. It never seemed to be something you liked. Did you ever come around on that?
Well,
or don't like hollering?
Well, you know, when it comes to you know, screaming and yelling like that, I think if the music is there to substantiate it, mm-hmm. you know, then fine. I mean, if it fits the dynamic of the song and the band, fine. But I felt like, you know, at that point in music, there was a lot of the trying to see, here we're singing and now we're yelling, you know? And so there was a lot of that where, to me, that as long as it works in the dynamic of the song, sure. But that felt really trendy to me at that time, because at that point it was like, okay, this is becoming a thing of its own.
Well, if some hillbillies from South Carolina can find their way into it, mm-hmm. then obviously it's already permeated through some layers to get down to us being able to do it. So it certainly couldn't have been on the cutting edge even at that time. And it's oddly, though, looking back on it, people like to say that we are early kind of screamy singy band, like even today, but mm-hmm. you rightly identify that even at that time it was behind, you know, well behind the curve. It was already a cliche to you in 2003.
But and you know, and that's the funny thing is, because you know, there was, you know, as you know, kind of every evolution of music has kind of gone on, you know, I see that, you know, once it kind of gets to a certain level, then it's like, for me, I'm like, okay, that's, you know, if this many people are already doing it, then, you know, it's already, you know, next year it's in Walmart.
Yep.
You know, and that's one of the things that, you know, if I can look into the crystal ball and see that stuff, then I want to try to, you know, push beyond mm-hmm. that and go, and let's think about what's next instead of what's happening now, because by the time your record comes out, it's going to be even more dated, mm-hmm. more dated. So that was one of the things that, you know, I was always trying to get bands to think about, hey, this is a really cool musical trend now, but by the time your record comes out, you're swimming with a million other fish doing the exact same trick.
Yep.
So try to think about what's, you know, what could be a little outside of that, what could be a little
different. We did a good job with all our screaming parts. Let's see if I can play one here. This one I particularly like, mainly because this is me screaming at the beginning. You still took the time to treat it well. This was your idea. It's me screaming the first lines in mono, and then the end of each line you had Toby do and double and pan that. So I don't know if people noticed that. So Toby's with that, and then me. And then Toby does the alive kind of thing all the way. So I think when you listen to that track, people don't really even notice that unless you're a big fan or really pay attention to that kind of stuff. But I thought that totally made that song. That wound up being one of our most popular songs from that record or forever. So that was your idea.
Well, and I was just, you know, I think, you know, when to get back to the hollering thing, right there in that context, perfect. I mean, I think that's, you know, what's going on with the drums and the guitars and everything supports it beautifully, you mm-hmm. know, and I think it fits right in the pocket there. So, I was going to say, I mean, in the mix sounds great too. Mm-hmm. So, hats off to, did J.R. McNeely do that?
Yeah, J.R. mixed it. Yeah.
Yeah. He did a great
job. You know what? I had just thought of something else that I forgot about on this is we, at the time, didn't know we were going to get signed or get somebody else to mix it. So mm-hmm. we recorded The Weeknd in 9 days. Yeah. Now, this is the craziest part is we recorded it in 9 days, and on the 10th day, you mixed the whole record.
Yeah.
We mixed 10 songs on the 10th day. Yeah. So we only had 9 days to track, and you literally mixed. You worked till 7 or 8 that night. and mix the whole record in one day.
Yeah.
And so we didn't use those mixes. Unfortunately, I don't have them. But obviously, that was just, you know, actually, there were some things on your mixes that I still to this day lament that were really cool. But it wasn't the same amount of time and everything that needed to be put into it ultimately when we released it. But I remember your mixes, in fact, were pretty awesome. But we didn't end up using them. But you literally mixed the whole week's in one day, and we tracked it in 9, which was unbelievable.
Again, that was one of those records that when I heard it after it had been mixed, I was like, man, they did a good job going with going with someone else, because you know he put a spin on it that you know I would have never considered.
Yeah, so. he did a good job. He'd mixed a few of our things and stuff like that. But you know, I really like somebody like you. The approach is so not. It's so bizarre to think about how not tone and gear driven it was. And especially because in that time, it's not like we're going to sit there and A-B mic. That's what people think we're going to talk about today. So what do you think about it, you know, U87 versus, you know, what stuff like that. And it's so, I know you have microphones you like and stuff like that, but it's so bizarre how that part never entered into it. I remember when we came in the first day, well, yeah, we did that week's end in 9 days, but the first day was pre-pro and practice, and the last day was mixing, so 8 days of tracking. But we came in the first day, set up all together, and we put this bass cab we had, just some bass cab, it wasn't even a 115 speaker, in a room, and you set us all up with headphones, and you tossed a 57 on a little stand in the vicinity of the bass amp to set up for headphones to whatever. Mm-hmm. And so then we all got headphones going and ran through the songs, and then the 2 days later, we started to track the bass. And I was so excited. I got up early, came down, said, I can't wait to see what mics he uses, what DIs, what's the signal chain going to be, stuff like that. And you said, okay, tune up. You had Joel tune up. And then you said, okay, we're going to start on this. I was like, well, what about the bass sound? What are we going to do for the bass sound? And you're like, oh, it sounds good to me. It was just that 57 that you put near the bass cab. Uh-huh. And that's what we recorded the bass with. And you didn't even readdress it or look at it or play with the placement with the flashlight or anything like that. I mean, I'm sure you had more thought when you put it where you put it in the first place. But from my point of view, you just threw 57 in the vicinity. And when it was time to track bass, let's talk about the tuning. Let's talk about the timing.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, for me, I've never been a gear snob. You know, mm-hmm. when it comes to like the recording stuff. I've always been more concerned with, you know, performances. And, you know, I think a lot of guys will get bogged down in gear mm-hmm. and forget that no one ever bought a fucking record because it was tracked with a U87.
Right.
You know, that has nothing to do with it. It's the performance that ultimately gets people to buy records, not what mic preamp you used.
Yeah, you even have a thing on your website that talks about preparation. I don't think I have time to read it, mm-hmm. but I almost want to read it out loud, but I'm going to ask everybody to go to edrose.com and look at the preparation link. It's all about recording and you being ready. Don't even think about anything until you do all the stuff that Ed says here. It's really good. It talks about, you know, how to have your demos ready, how to take care of your instruments, how to practice, what practice means. And, you know, listening and planning. And nowhere on there does it say, make sure you have this kind of humbucker or use these microphones or anything. It's nothing like that. So,
yeah.
Which is, I don't know. I think there's probably, you think there are a lot of producers that are a lot more gearhead than you, though?
Oh, completely. Yeah. No, I know that there are guys that are really, I mean, downright weird about, hey, man, I've got to be tracking on 1073s or we're not mm-hmm. doing drums, you know, and things yeah. like that. And it's like, okay, you know, if that's what, you know, allows you to make great records, then, you know, then that's your process. That's totally fine. But I always, you know, felt that, you know, if you had $1,000 to spend on drum tracks, it's better to spend them on good drums and good heads than mm-hmm.
Heads, yeah, and the tuning, yeah, starting yeah. from there. This is some stuff from the Appleseed cast that you recorded that's, you know, very different than us. But if you think about it, you can hear a way that this sounds like Emery's The Week's End, which is so interesting. It's partly period, partly the room, partly you. But I love the way this record is. Obviously, Cass was one of our favorite bands. That's on the Low Level Owl part one yeah. of theirs. Yeah, what do you remember about that?
Those Low Level Owl records are still some of the I think some of the best ones I've done.
Mm-hmm.
I was really, you know, lucky to, you know, meet up with those guys when I did. And
they're a Lawrence band.
Well, they, yeah. When I met them, they had just moved to Lawrence from, I believe, San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we did was Mari Vitalis, which was a 5-day record.
Wow. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. Which, you know, it turned out cool. Everybody was stoked on it. But it was so rushed that it was basically like, all right, did you get through your part without fucking up? All right, cool. Let's move on. Whereas with the low level records, we had a little time where we could, you know, try some different stuff. And by a little time, we did both of those records in 19 days total, mm-hmm. all in for both of them.
That's awesome. And yeah. So, you know, I know we don't have a ton of time left, but there's a couple more things I wanted to talk about. One is that you, despite the light I paint you in as far as being tough, which mm-hmm. I appreciate and learn so much from, one thing is everybody on the other side of the glass when they were tracking was like, is this the same guy? Because when you were tracking, you were unbelievably encouraging and supportive, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it's through the talk back, you have a whole different demeanor. You're aware of that?
Oh, of course.
And so yeah. How is it that, and I mean, I understand the importance of that, and everybody clearly does, how it is to make the singer feel good and try it again, or you've almost got it. I wonder why you feel like it's important to do that almost and expend that energy there, but not the rest of the time when you're working.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, in when tracking, it's important that the person on the other side of the glass feels comfortable and knows mm-hmm. that they're being supported and knows that, you know, I'm looking out for their best interest and I'm just only trying to get the best mm-hmm. performance out of them that I can. I'm not trying to do anything other than, you know, find out what your limit is and make sure you're performing at that limit all the time.
Mm-hmm. So it has this, you know, counter effect of like, oh, this is Ed. He's the one that's tough. He's the one that's rolling his eyes here. The one I can watch him with other people. But when I'm in there, I'm feeling like, hey, he thinks I'm doing good. I've almost got right. it. And Ed's a tough guy. So he would let me know. So that's the part of it that really balances out your whole demeanor that I'm sure is relatively unique for producers. That's one thing I'm sure I've seen and been around a ton. And that one is unique to you is that ability to flip those two. And actually, I'm going to say that your toughness, not in the talk back, and your honesty and things really play into how much more encouraging it is when you are on the other side of the talk back. So it also must be some amount of extra mental effort for you to do that. Does it, you feel like that's an cognitive expense at that time to do that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, when I'm sitting in front of the monitors, you know, you have my undivided attention 100%. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no like me, you know, dicking around with my phone while tracks are going down or anything. It's, you know, that's just maintaining that level of concentration throughout the course of a 10-hour day is tough. And I think, you know, whatever, you know, however that, you know, translates to when, you know, a take's going down, how I'm acting versus when there's not a take going down, how I'm acting. I think mm-hmm. that's just, you know, those are those, you know, just the differences in how I'm focusing at the time.
Well, hyper-focus, you definitely have that. Yeah. You definitely have that, which probably leads to more annoyance and stuff like that. So how, you know, you talked a little bit about things you got frustrated with, and there's a bunch of business, and you had the studio, and you sold the studio. We don't have time to get into all that stuff, but you ultimately decided to do this less, or you're not recording at all right now? Pryor said you have some gig at doing something really cool in Lawrence, though.
Yeah, no, let me tell you about that. The Lawrence Public Library, when it was remodeled in 2014, put a recording studio in there,
mm-hmm.
which anybody that has a valid Lawrence Public Library card can use for 2 sessions a month. And, you know, when I first heard about it, I was like, oh my God, that's, you know, that's brilliant. I mean,
yeah.
Trying to, you know, as a guy who tried to run a for-profit studio for basically his entire adult life and kind of saw what was happening with music and certainly, you know, directly affecting me, what was happening with budgets, you know, there's just not the money in music that there once was. So when I heard about this, I'm like, oh man, that's just brilliant. And then the library director, who was in this really great band called Vitreous Humor back in the day, had run across an old dad of his, and he was like, hey, Ed, do you still have a dat machine? I was like, sure. So I let him borrow my dat machine. And when I went to pick it up, I picked it up at the library, and he was showing me around the studio. And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. you know, are you guys doing this? Are you doing that? You know, what all you got going on? I was really curious about it. And so we end up having like this half hour conversation about what they're doing. And at the end of it, it was like, well, you know, go home and think about, you know, if you're able to turn this into a job, what would that look like? And, you know, 20 minutes after I got home, I had a job description written up and on his desk. And, yeah, I've just been loving it down there. But yeah, no, I think you're going to see a lot more of this too in libraries coming up, because based on the number of people that have contacted me from other libraries about doing something
similar.
Such
a cool idea.
Well, it really is. And, you know, the community is behind it 100%. I mean, if you wanted to book a weekend down there, you'd have to book it 2 months out now. It's getting so incredibly busy.
And before that, when you were doing, you started doing the restaurant, you did the Bourgeois Pig. You still do that?
Nope. I got out of that, in 2014. Now I got to a point where, you know, trying to, you know, continue to be, an engineer and a producer, while managing two small businesses just got to the point where it's like, it was just too much. I was just overwhelmed by it all. And, you know, luckily we found a buyer for the studio. And when that happened, it was like, hey, here's my opportunity to get out of the Bourgeois Pig too. So, luckily my partners were awesome about that. So I got out of that. And then, in 2014, just really only did, you know, a handful of mixing projects out of my house, and, kind of took some time for myself, and then started at the library in 2015. And I'm
that's
still cool. There.
That's interesting. I was talking to Mark Trombino last week, and he, you know, similarly was disenchanted with some music stuff and got interested in donuts, made a donut shop. I don't know if you heard that or not, but he has a donut shop in LA. So it's kind of parallel, doing less recording. Somebody who's from the same time period, done some really similar bands, and, got into the food industry as a proprietor there, just like you did. I think that's an interesting parallel. There's something about that. There must be some connection, obviously, there that people would draw that of music to food, which is, you know.
Well, and also for me, I mean, at that time it was, you know, a chance to diversify a little bit, you know, to get some of my money out of, you know, recording stuff and into something that was completely different than that. So,
well, they're both incredibly difficult competitive industries, but it's very hard to eke out profit too, which is bizarre.
True statement. Yeah.
Last thing I want to ask you is, you're a Full Sail graduate, and that Full Sail and a bunch of the other music recording programs around the country is, I don't know if people understand it or not, and I don't know if you have a recommendation or not, but it's unbelievable how many people that have come out of that school and other schools that are incredibly good, and how small percentage that can be. I've seen a million bums and interns and everything that have these crazy educations, and I typically tell people, just look, you can probably figure this stuff out. You know, I typically say, I'm not so sure about schools like that. I think you can learn anything you want on your own. However, I know several people that have come out of that school specifically that are just awesome. So I want to know if you think it was chicken or egg there.
Well, no, for me, now I got to preface this with, I went to Full Sail back in 1988, which was really long time ago. It was a completely different school back then. But, you know, at that point it was, you know, we call it a school, but it was a business, and the, it wasn't the primary focus of Full Sail was not making sure that little Ed Rose from Salina, Kansas, you know, was a happy engineer. It was like, did his fucking check clear? And so, I mean, at that point, it, you know, they were in there to make sure that, you know, my dad's checks got cashed, and that was pretty much it. The, you know, there were some instructors that were good. There were some that were terrible. The placement department totally laid an egg when I graduated. And, you know, the good thing is I ended up at a facility in Los Angeles where, you know, I got to learn everything I know. I mean, you know, if I look at what did I learn at Full Sail versus what did I learn as an intern and assistant at Studio 55, you know, I learned nothing at Full Sail and learned everything at Studio 55. And I was really lucky to have that opportunity.
How did you get it?
Well, when I told the placement department that I was going to Los Angeles to find an internship, and this is probably 2 weeks before I went out there, they're like, okay, yeah, we'll line some stuff up for you. And they I call him like the week before I'm leaving. It's like, what do you got set up for me? Well, we're still working on stuff. Check back in a couple days. So then that kept going until I got to Los Angeles, and it's like, hey, man, I'm here. I've got, you know,
whoa,
5 days, and I'm broke. So we've got to, you know, we've got to get something happening. And they were like, okay, well, we'll check back tomorrow. We'll have something for you. And so that happened every day until the last day I was there. And I was like, look, man, this is my last, you know, day in Los Angeles. I haven't been able to line up anything on my own. You guys haven't even gotten me an interview with any place. And the lady at the placement department was like, well, there is one Full Sail alum out there that, you know, may be able to direct you to a studio that we're just not thinking about. And so she set me up with David Dubow at Studio 55. And I went there, and he was super nice. And he was like, well, here's the deal. You know, we don't have anything open. You know, you can try dropping off resumes at these other places, but, you know, they're going to tell you the same story. You know, your school in particular has, you know, whatever it was, 50 kids jumping out of there every month, and they're all coming to the same places. You know, there's just not room
right
for it. And so, you know, we ended up, he takes me around the studio. We hang out, and, you know, at the end of it, he was like, here's the deal. You know, if this is what's standing between you and getting your certificate of completion, you know, you can come here, you can burn your 240 hours here, and I'll sign off on your stuff. And I was like, you know, at this point, you know, I'm going to have to take that because, you know, I don't have anything else to do. And there really wasn't a position there for me at all. But luckily, a week after I got there, one of the guys above me left. So then that, you know, translated into actually a full-time runner position. So just through the sheer luck of timing, I ended up, you know, getting lucky there.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that I find about it is, and you know, I'm glad to hear you say that in a way, not because I'm anti any particular school or whatever, but I feel like it's the same thing in all kinds of school. And this is a really good thing about that is I feel like there's something about school, and most of the people that I've observed that have recording certificates or programs or come in and do internships is they have almost developed this whole sense of, well, the placement department's supposed to do this. The engineer should get me to do this. The producer should tell me what to do. You know, I'm here to be directed, and right, that's just not the way the world is. I think middle school and high school are that way. I think mm-hmm. college is that way. So even more so, these recording programs, stuff like that. There's the myth of, well, you do all the stuff right, and then the things happen to you. It's just not even true. And you know, I've seen a million interns just sit still. And then you're like, hey, could you help me? And they're like, oh, what? You want me to? Oh, okay. And mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to anticipate, figure out, make their own luck, figure, you know, it's just a whole different thing. I think the schooling almost encourages that mindset.
No, I would agree with you.
It happens to you instead of from you.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing, too, is especially in recording, you've got to be a hustler to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. You've got to be able to go out there and, you know, create opportunities for yourself because, you know, ain't no one going to do that for you.
Right. Well, Ed, I appreciate your time today very much, and sorry if I ran over a little bit.
That's okay. It was great talking to you, man.
You know what? I'm not sorry, Ed. I'm not scared of you anymore.
Don't be.
Well, I thank you for being a pivotal and informative, you know, somebody that I've learned a ton from. I really do mean that sincerely. There's tons of lessons that I use both in music and not music I learned from you in 9 days. So thank you for that.
Absolutely, Matt. My pleasure.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right. We'll see you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the Jabberjaw Podcast Network, jabberjawmedia.com.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today, such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts. And new episodes come out every Monday.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.